Les conférences du Collège de France.
So this is lecture 2. I'm going to recap a bit quickly and then I'll say a lot about files, different things to explain, essential and non-essential indexicals. So last week I argued that the best way to think about concepts is not as public entities that can be grasped or possessed by different subjects, but as particular persisting objects inside the heads of individual subjects. Think something like words in the language of thought, or François Recanati's phrase mental files, some object inside the head of a subject to which bits of information get attached. So if you think about concepts in this way, there isn't really any question of two people sharing the same concept, numerically the same concept. I've got my nose, you've got your nose. I've got my concept of Keir Starmer, you've got your concept of Keir Starmer. But concepts can be typed as being of the same kind, and most obviously we can type them as having the same referent. So you can have a concept of Keir Starmer, I can have a concept of Keir Starmer. Some people want to type files, concepts, words in the language of thought, more finely. François Recanati, in his book Mental Files, types them by epistemically rewarding relations. He thinks a file in that book is constituted by whether you're in perceptual contact with its referent, or memory contact, or testimonial contact, and or so on. I argued that this presupposes an overly complicated cognitive architecture. We have a picture of inside people's heads are different repositories of information about the same object. Often the subject will know they're about the same object, has to transfer the information back and forth, all too complicated. And I gave an account, and this was the second half of my lecture last week, explaining why a system like that, with multiple files for a given referent, is overly complicated. You might think, what's the loss? I mean, that's an accurate way of thinking about things. It's not going to get you into any error. I argued that there's a perspective from which the aim of cognition is to have just one concept for each referent. I'm going to talk a bit about the one concept, one referent ideal. And you can think of this as the ideal, and that ideal is missed, that aim is missed, if either you have what are technically called in the literature confused ideas, one concept for two people. In the old philosopher's lexicon, we used to talk about somebody being locked. They thought that David Lewis and C.I. Lewis were the same person. They had one file for two reference. That's one kind of way of going wrong. Another kind of way of going wrong, and this isn't so widely recognized as a bad way, is to have two files for one referent. Those are Frege cases, where you perhaps don't realize that your two notions, Superman and Clark Kent, refer to the same person. Now, confused ideas are pretty obviously cognitive failures. You're going to end up with some false ideas if you take two people to be one. But I also wanted to argue that the latter cases, where you have two concepts for one referent, are also cognitive failures. Because in a clumpy world, a world that contains substances, a world that contains entities in which properties cluster, having two concepts for one referent results in inefficiency and so courts ignorance. So a rational subject will steer a middle course. They'll aim to avoid both Frege cases and confused ideas as far as possible. They'll aim to merge their files whenever it seems sensible to do so. And at this point, I should acknowledge, I had this picture up last week, but I didn't explicitly acknowledge it. That line of thought has been developed by my PhD student, Woody Jin, and I hope will soon come out in a paper in Mind and Language. Okay, so that's where I got to last week, more or less. So in line with what I just said, I want to offer the following picture of our cognitive architecture. Whenever I encounter some new object, some person, some animal species, some town, later on I'll be talking about events and places, and whenever I meet an object, or I hear about it, or I do some thinking and think there must be such an object, I infer, I open a file for it. I launch a file. And I'm henceforth aiming to enter all information I acquire about that object in that file. I want to talk about them as name-like files. They're like proper names. Their job is just to refer to an object, accumulate information about it. It's a permanent file, like a proper name in that way. Doesn't derive its content for any specific relationship, seeing, remembering between the subject and the referent. It's just a repository designed to accumulate as much information as possible about the referent. And the line I'm going to push in this lecture is that all our referring terms in thought are like this. They're just like names. They don't refer in virtue of any special mode of presentation or sense. They're just directly referring terms. Now, it's easy to get misled by terminology here. People often talk about demonstrative thoughts, demonstrative mode of reference, perceptual demonstratives. I'll come back to those. And they're distracted often by the way in which we express our thoughts being not name-like. I mean, here's an example. I know some woman perfectly well. I know her name. We're at a cocktail party. I know that you don't know her name. I say to you, that woman's a barrister. I refer to her with the phrase, that woman. So I'm using a demonstrative phrase, but which is not name-like. That woman is not a name. That woman's a phrase that will refer to different people on different occasions of use. But we don't want to think I have a demonstrative thought. My thought is just, Anne is a barrister. She's a barrister. I've got a file for that woman. I know she's a barrister. I convey this information to you. But I convey the information to you using a demonstrative phrase, because I know you don't know the name for that woman. Here's that picture. That picture's by my daughter. I told you that last week. I refer to the picture by the name, by the phrase, that picture. But there's no need for me to think that I've got a separate thought from the thought I've had for a long while, that picture is by my daughter. I mean, picture is by my daughter, just that I express that thought, that name-like thought, using a demonstrative construction. So don't be misled about the terminology. So I'm going to push the line that all referring thoughts are name-like. Now, some of you might be worrying, and we'll keep coming back to this, what about indexical thoughts? Didn't John Perry and others teach us that much cognition is essentially indexical? We can't understand our cognitive situation, our cognitive engagement with the world, without supposing we have some thoughts in which terms are essentially indexical. Okay, I'm going to come back to what exactly indexical is, but think indexical thoughts are thoughts that involve a term, a file, a word in the language of thought that refers to different objects on different occasions of use. That's what we're going to mean by indexicality. A referring item, a vehicle of thought that refers variously depending on the context of use. I mean, terms like that woman, that picture, later on here, now, and so on, are all indexical terms. And Perry argued that we can't understand our engagement with the world, our cognitive engagement with the world, without recognizing that we have some thoughts that are indexical. Now, in fact, I'll come back to that, and I'm going to grant at the end of this lecture that there are a few very special cases where thoughts are essentially indexical. But I want to say they play a very specific action-guiding role, and they're kind of outside the arena of the kind of mental files, the kind of accumulation of information I've been talking about. I want to push this name-right model pretty hard. I want to apply it even to so-called perceptual demonstratives. Do we have a cup here? Look, no, here, look at that. I've just met this cup, and this cup, I refer to it by a demonstrative phrase. But I want to say I've opened a name-like file for that cup, and I'm going to use it whenever I think about that cup, as I'm doing now, and re-identify it, recognize it. If you tell me about the cup later, I'm going to open and exercise the same file. Might think of this kind of launching of a file as associated with the object files in early vision that I talked about briefly last week. I don't want to make the connection too close. I think object files in early vision happen automatically, subpersonally. But sometimes when we attend to an object that we're perceiving or start thinking about it a bit, then we'll open, perhaps based on the files in early vision, a permanent name-like file for that cup, that particular cup. Might seem a bit odd, but I think this is the best way to think about my thinking about that cup. Look, I don't want to keep that. I don't think. I'm not going to keep it for very long. Perhaps hard to tell. I mean, maybe it will just atrophy away in a day or so. I'm hesitating because you know those magic eye things? Where you look at some kind of pattern of dots, you look at it for 10 minutes, and then it comes into focus as it's some underwater scene with pirates or something. I went into a bar 10 years later recently that had one of those things, and this time I looked for 5 seconds and it came out. And my brain had remembered the precise way to match that pattern of dots to get it into 3D. And it was kind of scary that the information of that trivial kind gets kept in your brain. So maybe these files don't atrophy that fast, but still. Look, there's going to be cases where somebody's been tricky, come in and switch a different cup. I turn around, I think it's the same cup, and it's not. I've got one file, I'm putting information from two different cups in there. Or maybe sometimes I'll see a cup over there and I'll take it to be a different cup when it's the same cup. And I'll be putting information into two different files when I do better to put it into one. And that's going to happen. But that's just what happens in all cases of forming files to refer to and accumulate information about objects. There are these twin dangers of confused ideas or Frege cases of failing to merge. And that just applies in the same way to these so-called perceptual demonstratives, which I say are not demonstrative at all. In thought, there's nothing demonstrative. I formed a name for this particular object. Okay, I've persuaded you that, well, maybe I haven't, but I've been pushing the idea that we need to think of referring thought as constituted by name-like entities in the mind, and a healthy mind will just have one name for each object. You might still think we might want to classify these names in different ways. I've said already, look, it's obvious that we want to classify them in terms of what they refer to. Two different names of this kind can refer to the same object. But you might want to think that there's ways of classifying these names that are more fine-grained, more like Phrygean senses. You think of an object in one way, I think of it a different way. I, in fact, in a Frege case, might well think of a given object in two different ways. So there's going to be lots of different particulars all referring to the same object. Maybe we want to think about among those particulars, some refer to the object in one way and some refer to it in a different way. We might have to think using Fregean terminology of senses or perhaps modes of presentation. These different names might sometimes be thought of as referring to a given object in a certain way, presenting it in a certain way. And many people looking at this suggestion that we can just do with a name-like view of things want to say, no, look, there's a whole lot of things that we need modes of presentation, Fregean senses, to explain. We want to think about the way you're thinking about something and not just what you're thinking about in order to do various things, in order to explain how individuals will think and act, in order to explain what's going on when we attribute beliefs or other propositional attitudes to people, in order to explain what's going on when two people communicate. Just thinking of people's thoughts is about certain objects, the suggestion is going to be, isn't going to be enough to explain these things. We need also to think about how do the people think about those objects. Okay, I'm going to go through these three things in order. So, first of all, reasoning and action. And I can remember, there was a time when I was younger that I thought in just this way. Why do we need to think of people as having different ways of thinking about something? And I thought, well, it's obvious. I mean, you think of something in one way, you think of Paris in the way that an inhabitant of Paris thinks about it. I think about Paris in the way that somebody who's just read about it and maybe visited once or twice thinks about it. And the fact that we think about it in different ways explains why we behave differently. You don't have to look at a map in order to figure out where to go. You know which way to turn. You know which way to go to find the nearest bar and so on. I have to look. Don't we want to explain the differences in our behavior in terms of our having different ways of presenting this object? I can remember Michael Devitt saying to me, David, that's a terrible argument. That's a terrible argument because, look, even if we think of our concepts of Paris being just the same, we're still going to have to recognize that you have lots of beliefs about Paris that I lack. And maybe vice versa. Maybe I've got a few ideas about Paris that you like. We're going to have different, as it's now said, conceptions of Paris, where conceptions just mean all the information attached to our respective names of Paris, all the information in our respective files. And that's obviously going to be different, even if we think of the files as just two names of Paris. That's how they to be counted as names. They're just the same kind of name. They refer to the same thing. But using that name, you have a whole lot of beliefs, and I have a whole lot of different beliefs. And that in itself is enough to explain why we behave and reason in different ways. So if we're thinking about just explaining the way people are going to think and behave differently, even though they're referring to the same thing, it's easy enough to just say, well, don't make the names different. They're just names for that thing. Just attend to the fact that the two people have different beliefs. What about belief attribution? When I say of somebody that she believes that Paris is the capital of France, or she believes, right, we're now supposing a fictional story, that Clark Kent works at a newspaper. What exactly are we saying? Okay, this is a long-standing issue. Frege said, well, once we bring in senses, modes of presentation, as well as reference, we can take ourselves to be reporting the sense with which somebody thinks a thought, as opposed to reporting just the reference. So I'm not just reporting that so-and-so has a belief about Clark Kent / Superman, the same person. I'm reporting that they're thinking it with their Clark Kent concept and not their Superman concept. You're thinking about Paris with your Paris concept, not with mine. Now, in fact, the standard Fagain approach runs into all kinds of problems. It's quite striking that the people I referred to last week as wanting to type concepts more finely than reference, both Sainsbury and Tai and Francois Recanati, neither of them think that their typing is sufficient to account for belief attribution. And the truth is, belief attribution is a very messy and context sensitive interest relative business. I think what's going on is that when we attribute belief to somebody, in the first instance, we're talking about the referential content of their beliefs. We're just saying they got a belief about Paris, about Superman / Clark Kent. But we're also conveying in our belief attributions something about the way they think about that object. And in particular, in the most striking cases, the fact that they think about it in two different ways. So somebody might know that Clark Kent is a journalist but not think that Superman is a journalist. Or in Quine's famous example, somebody might believe that Oortcut is a spy but not that the man in the brown hat is a spy, even though the man in the brown hat is in fact Oortcut. So when we say somebody believes that such and such, I take us to be doing two different things. First of all, saying what their concepts refer to, and also conveying a bit about the nature of their concepts, and perhaps that sometimes they have two concepts for one person. The issue we need to address is whether such indications of what somebody is thinking are informed by any systematic inter-individual way of classifying mental terms. Is there some canonical way of dividing up the way people think about things such that we can say that when you make a belief report, you're alluding to that way of thinking about things? And I doubt it. I think it's just a very messy business. When belief reporting or reporting what somebody says in indirect speech, have I done it right? Depends on the context, depends on what you're interested in. Maybe you think at first pass to get it right is to explain what the truth condition, the referential content of their thought is. But sometimes you might feel I've misreported what they're thinking or what they said if I use a misleading term. The philosophers have concentrated on these very clear cases, like Superman and Clark Kent, cases where there's widespread ignorance about identity, specifically because because the entity in question goes around in two disguises. The two guises get to be associated with two words, Superman and Clark Kent, and then we can say that somebody is thinking of the person under this guise or that guise by using the words Superman and Clark Kent. But they're very special cases when an entity has two guises that get associated with two words. And we shouldn't allow these very special cases to dictate the whole way we think about concepts. In this connection, it's worth noting that a lot of human files, perhaps nearly all our files, we get as members of the linguistic social community. And so mostly we open new files in our cognitive system. When we hear a new word, we hear a name of somebody, we hear a name for some object, we hear a name of some town, we hear. So our files tend to be associated with public words. And perhaps the standard source of Frege cases is when people don't realize that two different public words refer to the same thing. And so this will be a case where we do have ignorance of identity because a certain entity appears in two verbal guises. And in those cases, we use the public words to attribute the belief to people. We have in mind that they have two different files associated with the two words, and we can convey that using this file or that file by using the words. And this deals very nicely with the hyper-intentional cases that are so problematic for Fregeans. Take any two synonymous words. I was once told that the only two really synonymous words in English are gorse and furze. It's a kind of plant. It's a kind of plant. Kind of slightly spiky with little yellow flowers. And so for Fregeans, these words are synonymous. Somebody who thinks a gorse thought thinks about gorse, thinks about furze. They ought to be using the same mode of presentation. They're the same. The two words have the same meaning. But it's perfectly clear that many people think that some things about gorse, but not about furze, because they don't realize the two words co-refer. The apparatus I've now got makes it easy to explain what's going on here. We're referring to the fact that the person has two files associated with the two words. We're not saying anything about the way the object is being presented to them beyond that. Communication. What is it for one person to communicate a thought to another? Well, if we're thinking of thoughts as involving names and names as typed just by what they refer to, natural first response is to say, I communicate a thought to you just in case you come to house a thought with the same truth condition, same referential value as the thought I intended to communicate to you. That seems to be the end. I communicate a thought, I get you to have the thought I have, and what is it to have the same thought? Well, the terms involved refer to the same things. But it's easy enough to generate apparent counterexamples to this claim. So it's Brian Law's example. Two guys, friends, they were watching television together last night. They saw some guy dressed up on talking on an economics program, and then next day they're on the train, and one says to the other, that guy's an idiot, isn't he? And the hearer takes the speaker to be referring to a person behaving slightly oddly on the seat across the aisle of the train. But in truth, the speaker is referring to the person they both watched last night. That guy we're talking about, he's an idiot, isn't he? But let's suppose that the person on the train is in fact the same person who was on the television last night dressed up in a suit. So the speaker is referring to that person, and the hearer comes to think the speaker is conveying the thought about the same person, that they're an idiot. But on the face of it, this doesn't look like a case of communication at all. The speaker was intending to refer to the guy on the television. The hearer takes him to be referring to the guy on the seat. And it's just an accident that the two happen to be the same. And many people want to plug this gap by putting extra conditions on the identity of thoughts. You only communicate if you communicate the same thought, and thoughts have to be typed more precisely than what they're about. You communicate a thought not if your hearer gets to be thinking about the same things, but only if they get to be thinking about the same things in the same way. But it's better not to try and put extra conditions on the same thought in this context. Look, there's nothing wrong with the idea that two thoughts might be in some sense similar, more or less similar, in addition to what they refer to. You might be thinking of Paris in a very different way from me. I don't want to rule that out as something that makes sense. But it'd be a bit odd to try and develop an account of communication based on that kind of thought. You'd have to somehow specify how similar do the thoughts have to be in order for it to count as communication. And that looks like a mug's game. I mean, counting similarity, there are lots of dimensions. It'll vary from one context to another what we think is relevantly similar. Much better to say, no, you've got communication if the thought communicated the thought adopted as a result of the utterance has the same referential value as the thought the speaker is trying to communicate, and put extra conditions on what's required for it to be a case of communication. And in particular, you may as well just say what I said a moment ago, that in this case it was an accident that the two thoughts had the same referent, and you want to say it's a case of communication only if the fact that the hearer's thought and the speaker's thought have the same reference is not an accident. And I was speaking to Francois Recognati earlier about where does this idea come from? I had a student in New York about 8 years ago. We were working on this, I mean, related issues, and she came up with this suggestion, I think, off her own bat in a term paper. And I know Victor Tamburini is working in this area and has a talk about it. But Francois says that the idea goes back to 20 years, 30 years, to a paper by Buchanan, who made the point that you can account for the requirements for communication just by specifying that the conveying of information not be fortuitous. So normally when speaker wants to convey some information to somebody, they want to get their hearer to focus on the object of interest. So I might ask you, I might point to the object of interest, I might describe it, I might use a name, I might refer to it anaphorically, referring back to some earlier conversation. And normally the hearer will pick up on what I'm doing and focus, as it were, in the same direction. And when we get to focus in the same way on the object, then that's a case of communication. But that's not what's going on in the law example. I'm trying to get you to focus anaphorically on the guy we were looking at last night, and you focus on the guy across the aisle. And it's just an accident that the two are the same, and that's why it's not communication. Okay, so what did I have? Reasoning and action, belief attribution, communication. None of them are served by classifying thoughts more finely than reference. Okay, I'm now going to come to the issue of indexicality and essential indexicality. Which thoughts, if any, are essentially indexical? First, I want to clarify exactly what we should understand by the term indexicality. And I want to focus on specific understanding, pretty standard understanding, that indexicality is character-like. That you've got some item, some vehicle of thought, word, mental file, whatever you want to call it. And the same vehicle refers to different things on different occasions of use. Not sure indexical is always used like that. In Recanati's book, Mental Files, which I've talked about before, he has a referring term, a vehicle of thought, that is constituted by being able to see the object, another such item that's constituted by remembering the object, another one perhaps constituted by re-identifying the object, and he calls these files indexical. And, I mean, perfectly reasonable terminology, and the reason he used this term was to emphasize that the reference of these files is not constituted by the information inside the file. The files don't get referred to what they refer to, because that's the one and only thing picked out by the information in the file. The information in the file might be very thin and not pick out that thing uniquely. The file refers to what it does because of its external relation, its environmental relation to that object. My perceptual file refers to the thing I'm perceiving, because that's the thing in front of me, not because I have enough information to uniquely identify it, and so on. Perfectly reasonable use of the term indexical. Reference is fixed in virtue of the item in question being in a certain context. So reference is context dependent. But that doesn't yet involve the idea of reference shifting from occasion to occasion. And that doesn't apply to Recanati's indexical files. When I open a perceptual file for some person, a file might cease to exist when I stop perceiving, but it's not like it refers to somebody different on different occasions of use. You might think, well, think about object files in early vision. Think about Millikan has things she calls templates. So you might think you've got a kind of stock of potential referring terms. And I see an object, I pull one of those referring terms down and I stick it onto that cup. Or I see a new animal, I pull down an animal referring term and stick it onto the animal. And you might think, look, these referring terms, they could have been used to refer to some different animal. Those things could be reused to refer to something different on a future occasion. Not sure I want to especially think like that, but note, the thing doesn't get to refer until, it doesn't get to be a referring term until it's locked onto a referent. So the file, my cup file, my rhinoceros file, gets to be a referring term once it's used to refer to rhinoceros, and that referring term doesn't get to refer to anything else except the thing it got locked onto. So, indexicality for me is some referring term, some vehicle of thought that refers to different things. The same vehicle of thought refers to different things on different occasions of use. Now, I've already said that many demonstrative expressions, that woman, that cup, they're really indexical in this sense. I mean, they're character-like. I mean, technically, these are not strictly indexicals, but they have this feature that the words, that woman, clearly refers to lots of different women on different occasions of use. That cup, the words, refer to lots of different cups on different occasions of use. But that doesn't mean, I've argued, that the referring term in thought that they're expressing is similarly indexical. I have a referring term in my mind for Anne, the barrister, and that just always refers to Anne. Nothing character-like demonstrative there. I want to say the same even for pure indexicals like now and here and so on. at first pass. I'm going to come back. I mean, I'm not going to push this all the way. But I still want to say that plenty of uses, most uses of expressions like now, here, I'm going to talk in a minute about today, yesterday, and so on, are indexical in the words, but the thoughts they're expressing are not indexical. Here's Frege's famous example. Someone wants to say today what he expressed yesterday using the word today. Yesterday he used the word today to say today is very rainy. He'll replace the word the next day with yesterday. Frege says, because although the thought is the same, the verbal expression must be different. So Frege's here, somewhat surprisingly, on my side. He thinks that you've got one thought on Wednesday you express with today, and on Thursday you express with yesterday. Now, I mean, people working on Frege find this difficult. How can it be the same thought if it's presented in different ways? Frege, by and large, types thoughts by the way they're presented. But in this passage in particular, I think Frege has it right. It is the same thought, and while we're presenting it in different ways in language, using today and yesterday, we aren't presenting it in different ways to ourselves in our head. I want to say we formed a name, a mental name, for the day in question. You might be able to date it, November the 24th, 2024. But you might just have an idea that day. You remember it all right. That you've got a file for that day. And then you will exercise it on different occasions. On different occasions, you use different words to express the thought, but your thought is just about that day picked out in a name-like way. I want to say this in a lot of funny cases where Fregeans or philosophers of language more generally want to say we've got to recognize indexical modes of presentation, cases where people lose track of time. Look at, here's Rip Van Winkle. Before the American Revolution, he says, it's a lovely day today. He falls asleep, wakes up 20 years later and says, it was a lovely day yesterday. Don't we have to think in this kind of case where he's lost track of time that he's presenting the day before indexically? I don't think so. I think he's got a name-like file for that long past day. He opened it before he fell asleep. He's got the idea it was lovely. And later on, he mis-expresses his thought. He wants to say of that day, the one he has a name-like file for, it was lovely. He expresses this thought with yesterday. In fact, this is not a happy way of expressing it. But, it's the thought he's expressing that particular name day was lovely. You might think, look, hang on, surely he can have a name-like file for today, the day he wakes up. Surely you can think about this day. I mean, if I think you can think about days in a name-like way, why not think about this day? And so can't he think about the day before this day via that description, open another file for the day before yesterday? Sorry, the day before today, the day before the day he's woken up on. Okay, then you'll have two files. The file for the day before this day he can think about directly, and the file for the day 20 years ago before he fell asleep. And he's merged them. He thinks those are the same day, and he's confused. It's a confused idea. But still, confused ideas are what you get with name-like files. No reason to credit Rip with anything but name-like files so far. You might be wondering, why am I pushing everything into the name-like framework here? I mean, can't Rip form an unconfused indexical thought the day one day ago? I mean, why can't he think about a day before now? Well, I think he can. But I think human beings really do think like that, and there's a good reason. We often express our thoughts like that, but we don't really think like that. So, occasions, events, things located at certain points in space and time, are themselves substances, kind of things that you might want to have mental term for. They're things that can be identified in lots of ways and which have lots of features. Same goes for locations, places. They're things that we want to be able to think about, and because we can, a lot of properties will cluster in any particular location. So we want to be able to think about occasions and locations. How are we going to refer to them? Well, one way of referring to them is egocentrically, via the relation they bear to me now. So let me think about the room I'm sitting in, and there's the television 5 feet in front of me, and there's the easy chair off to my right. And that's a way one might think about locations in the room. But that's not a very good way of thinking about them, because as soon as I move or turn, I'm going to have to identify those things in a different way. The thing that's in front of me when I'm like this will be off to my right when I do that. And you don't want to be thinking about locations in such a way all the time, because every time you move, you're going to have to update your framework for referring to the locations. So it's much better to not name things, locations, places, by their relation to you, but by some kind of naming system. And when you do that and take yourself out the picture, you can think of those locations spatially related to each other in not an egocentric way, but an allocentric way. A map of where they all are that removes you from the picture. If you want to find a way around, you might figure out where you are in the map and which way you're pointing, and then everything will be fine. But a much more economical way of representing all those places and where they are in relation to each other is to take yourself out of the representation. Same goes for time. We could think of a certain day as 2 days ago, and then the next day we'd have to think of it as 3 days ago, and so on, and we'd have to update the name for that thing all the time. Better to take yourself out the picture, give the all the events their own names, and think about how they're related in the spatial, in the temporal dimension, without worrying about where you are, and then again you can figure out how you relate to them by seeing where you are in that allocentric map. So, you don't want to be thinking about even occasions, events, things in time, or places, locations, things in space, in an indexical way. You want to be thinking about in a name-like way, abstracted from their relation to you, much more efficient form of representation. And that's how we normally think. Except, and I'm going to stop in a second, when we speak and act, then we need to bring in indexical modes of representation. It was implicit in all the things I've been saying about we use the word that woman. Rip uses the word yesterday. I said he misexpressed himself when he said yesterday. Why did he misexpress himself? Because he thought the day in question was one day ago, and that's why he spoke wrongly. His utterance was informed by his mistaken information that the day in question was one day ago. So when you speak, and more generally when you act, you need to locate yourself in space and time in order to get moving. Think about, I'll just finish with this example. I want to reread, as I'm going to have to before my fourth lecture, the last section of Naming a Necessity. So I want to pick up the book, and so I walk around, and here's one book, it's here now in front of me. Here's another book, it's here now in front of me. And here's Naming a Necessity, here now in front of me. And now I grab it. And I need it to be the case that Naming Necessity is here now in front of me in order to get me grabbing. We need a thought of that form to trigger action. Now, so I'll start next time with the fact that when it comes to action, essential indexicals are needed. And I'll point out that this really is a case of real character-like reference. And because of that, it's something that plays no real role in the structure of mental files. And I'll finish this bit next time by saying some people are puzzled about how deliberation and the motor system interact. They say there's an interface problem. The motor system speaks one language, the deliberative system speaks another. I'll show you no. The deliberative system and the motor system are designed to merge with each other. In fact, if you think about it, the whole purpose of deliberation is to get us to act. So the idea that deliberation could have evolved in a way that cuts it off from the systems that direct action is kind of makes no sense. In fact, the real puzzle in this area is finding out, trying to understand how deliberation ever manages to be decoupled from action. And that's going to be the main topic for me next week. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.